This is going to be MRAP Bariatric Emergencies with Arvind Venkat. Unsurprisingly, we are seeing more and more patients post-bariatric surgery in the emergency department. We discussed a case back in April 2017 of an acute abdominal pain presentation post-bariatric surgery, but the last time we did a dedicated segment on this topic was way back in November 2012. I think it's time to rectify that oversight. With me today is Arvind Venkat, Vice Chair in the Department of Emergency Medicine at Allegheny Health Network in Pittsburgh and National Director of Research for U.S. Acute Care Solutions. Dr. Venkat is a professor of emergency medicine at the Drexel University College of Medicine. He is the current president of the Pennsylvania College of Emergency Physicians. Arvind, welcome to MRAP.
Pleasure to be here.
Bariatric surgery basics.
All right, when we talk about bariatric surgery, we're not talking about one procedure. We kind of lump it all together, but we're actually talking about a collection of different approaches. Give us the short version of the different procedures that are offered and what most of our patients are getting now.
You're absolutely right. And the statistics on bariatric surgery are really extraordinary. According to the American Society for Metabolic and Bariatric Surgery, the number of operations that are taking place has really exploded from 158,000 in 2011 to 228,000 in 2017, which is the last year for which they published statistics. The two main approaches to bariatric surgery are either to restrict dietary intake or to bypass part of the gut to avoid caloric absorption. When I finished my residency training in 2004, the most common procedure was the Roux-en-Y gastric bypass, but that's no longer the case today. The most common procedure is a laparoscopic sleeve gastrectomy, in which there is a removal of a section of the stomach to decrease stomach size and to change gut hormones. And that's about 60% of the procedures that are performed today. Roux-en-Y gastric bypass, in which a section of the stomach is removed and there's diversion of food from part of the small bowel, is another 18%. And then lesser procedures such as gastric banding, biliary pancreatic diversion, and gastric balloons all make up less than 3% of the remaining procedures that are performed. And then there are revisions that are performed every year as well. And that's about 15% of the procedures that are performed every year.
And I'm sure some of this is a little bit regional. You have to kind of know what your bariatric surgeons are doing, because in certain places, you'll see kind of a pocket where everyone's getting gastric bands and not some of the other procedures. And this is going to really be the flavor of where you work and finding out, again, what your surgeons do.
Complications.
Now, I'm guessing that the different procedures means that there's going to be different complications to actually consider.
Absolutely. For procedures that surgically change the anatomy of the GI tract, you need to think about operative complications, breakdowns of suture lines that cause anastomotic leaks, hernias, obstructions. While for those that externally affect intake of calories, you have to think about problems like band migration or balloon complications. There are also the typical surgical complications, infections, pulmonary embolism, etc.
Laparoscopic bands.
Let's get into this by starting with the laparoscopic band procedures. Now, you said this is a minority of the procedures, but again, you're going to see some hotbeds, some areas of the country where you're going to see more of those. What complications do we need to think about early in the post-op course of a laparoscopic band?
So up to 2% of these procedures will have band erosion or migration. This will cause a patient to present with intractable nausea and vomiting, poor weight loss, and acid reflux. The diagnosis is usually made by a gastrographin radiographic study, and it often requires revision or conversion to a non-reversible procedure, such as a sleeve gastrectomy or a Roux-en-Y gastric bypass.
Let's say the patient had a pretty normal post-op course, and now they're coming in a month or two after surgery. What are the common complications that we see in that group?
So at that time, most of the laparoscopic band complications would have likely passed, but you can see issues related to patients not following their dietary restrictions. And as a result, you can see complications such as gastric dilation and poor weight loss that are issues that can arise later on.
Laparoscopic Roux-en-Y procedure.
Well, let's jump back to the Roux-en-Y procedure, the one that you said used to be the most common. It has now become less so. What complications do we see early on with these patients?
So the most feared complication is an anastomotic leak. This is when there's a suture line breakdown and the connection of the small bowel to the gastric pouch opens. The problem is that the presenting symptoms can be quite vague. Classic peritoneal signs may not be present. Instead, the emergency physician can see restlessness, back pain, pelvic pressure, low-grade fever, borderline tachycardia, or even hiccups has been reported in the literature as how patients will present. You have to have a high suspicion and a low threshold for CT scan and early surgical consultation. The other concern is pulmonary embolism. This has a very high mortality rate in this patient population when present, up to 20 to 30%. One of the challenges is that the signs and symptoms can be quite similar to an anastomotic leak, so both complications have to be kept in mind.
And if you're thinking about these things, you might end up having to get that CT that comes down from the sternal notch all the way through the abdomen and pelvis in order to make the diagnosis. And these are complicated surgical patients. This is not a simple procedure necessarily. It's why we've kind of moved to other procedures now. But we really do have to think about some pretty significant complications. Arvin, what happens later in the post-op course in those Roux-en-Y Y patients?
So the three most common complications later on that come up are internal hernias, GI bleeds from suture line issues, and stomal stenosis, in which the connection between the small bowel and the gastric pouch narrows. The first two are the most emergent, as they can require either surgical or GI intervention. For internal hernias, CT scans are the best way to make the diagnosis. For GI bleeds, the key issue is to recognize that these patients may require more aggressive resuscitation, as they have less oral intake than your typical patient who presents with a GI bleed. A small amount of blood loss may cause more extreme symptoms. For stomal stenosis, patients will present with a sensation of fullness in the upper abdomen and discomfort, and a swallowing study can confirm the diagnosis. Usually, these patients can be discharged to have an outpatient dilation procedure.
Gastric sleeve.
So a lot of why we are discussing this is because you did publish an article on this 11 years ago in the Journal of Emergency Medicine. It was a great overview of the different procedures. But since then, the gastric sleeve procedure has become much more common. Are there different complications that we see immediately post-op with that set of patients?
So this procedure is less technically challenging than the Roux-en-Y gastric bypass procedure. One can see typical post-operative complications after a laparoscopic sleeve gastrectomy. But as there are no changes in the anatomy of the GI tract beyond removal of a portion of the stomach, emergency physicians should not usually see the more feared complications such as an anastomotic leak or internal hernias. That's one of the reasons that this procedure has become more common. It's surgically, technically easier to do, and a lot of those complications aren't present, and the patient can get an equivalent amount of weight loss.
Management.
Let's talk a little bit about management of these patients when they come in. Let's say that we have a Roux-en-Y patient with severe abdominal pain that's peritoneal. It's about 2 weeks post-op. Now, we're thinking about anastomotic leaks. Walk me through your approach to management in these patients and also what imaging you're going to select.
So the first step, as always, is ABCs. Make sure you have good IV access, begin fluid resuscitation, and do a careful history and physical examination. I think you need to send a broad lab evaluation, including whatever is needed if the patient has to go to surgery, so typical pre-op labs. If the patient looks ill, my go-to imaging study is going to be a CT scan, and it's really to include the CT scan of the chest for pulmonary embolism and abdomen pelvis to look for things like an anastomotic leak or an internal hernia. The key is to get a definitive study and to have a low threshold for early surgical consultation. In many cases, a bariatric surgeon, when hearing the story and examining the patient, may decide that the best thing to do is to go straight to the operating room to evaluate whether there's one of these complications present.
Yeah, I think that's a good call. Getting your consultant involved early, especially because they know these complications, they know what the risks are, and sometimes it's easier just to take them back to the operating room and take a look. Now, how does this change if we're 2 weeks post-lap band?
So the ABCs first and foremost. And then since band migration and erosion are common complications, a gastrographin study upper GI series is going to be the most high yield test to see if that is present. CT scans are a little bit limited in this regard for the gastric band patient.
Does anything change in your workup if the patient is 3 months post-op from that lap band as opposed to just 2 weeks? And we can apply the same in the Roux-en-Y patient as well. If we're 3 months post-op, am I worrying about different things? Is my workup going to be different?
So at 3 months, the likelihood of an anastomotic leak is less, as is that of a pulmonary embolism, though both can still happen. This is the time period when complications such as internal hernias, staple line disruptions with GI bleeds, and stomal stenosis can take place. My approach is to ensure that the patient is adequately resuscitated, has a broad lab evaluation, have a low threshold for CT imaging, and if needed, either surgical consultation or close surgical follow-up.
How does this change if the patient is 3 months post-op from a gastric sleeve instead of the Roux-en-Y or the lap band? What are you thinking about in those patients, and what's your workup?
I rarely see patients who are a number of months out with surgical complications of a laparoscopic sleeve gastrectomy. I still think you have to approach it with ABCs, appropriate resuscitation, and have a low threshold for CT imaging, but the yield may be less, and the typical complications that may come up are not the surgical complications we think of, but those outside of the GI tract.
So I think that's a really important distinction to make, is you're still going to evaluate these patients the same if they look sick. You might still get the CT scan, but don't be surprised to find a complication that has nothing to do with that prior surgery. And you might hear this from your consultant as well when you call them. They might be a little bit more reluctant to just take that patient back to the operating room, knowing that the complication rate's pretty low, and they might want that imaging so they can really see what's going on and figure out what is the next step that needs to be taken.
Other complications.
Now, of course, you mentioned a little bit about this, but it's not all GI stuff that can go wrong. You mentioned pulmonary embolism, but what are the other complications after these surgical procedures that we have to be thinking about?
So the most feared complication that I think everybody has to worry about are neurologic complications after bariatric surgery due to vitamin deficiencies and specifically related to thiamine. With the most common bariatric surgeries involving resection of large parts of the stomach, these patients have to be on continuous vitamin supplementation to ensure adequate levels. When these patients develop poor oral intake, they can present with the signs and symptoms of thiamine deficiency, progressing all the way to encephalopathy and death. I personally have reviewed a malpractice case against emergency physicians where a patient presented on multiple occasions with vague and progressive neurologic symptoms where none of the treating physicians, including a neurologist, caught on that the patient's history of vomiting, previous gastric bypass, and poor vitamin supplementation intake. I now have the practice when I see these patients that if there is any concern about oral intake, to give them a dose of thiamine to ensure that this issue is covered.
And we've reviewed Wernicke's encephalopathy and Korsakoff's in the past, and I think we try to stress the fact that it's not just the chronic alcoholics that are getting this. Any patient with chronic disease, end-stage renal disease, end-stage liver disease, cancer, and the patients with bariatric surgery are in that group. These are high-risk populations to develop Wernicke's. We have a really easy, simple, and almost no downside treatment. It's just a matter of thinking about this. So if you see a patient with some vague neurologic symptoms or vague neurologic complaints who has bariatric surgery in the past, think about Wernicke's encephalopathy, supplement that thiamine. Remember that if you're treating Wernicke's, the dose is much different than if you're just trying to prevent it. But I think if we can put these things together in our mind, we're less likely to miss those patients. So this is a nice marriage.
Summary.
Arvin, that's a great review of the different bariatric surgery procedures, the complications we need to think about. I think one of the main things that I take away from this is how the surgical procedures themselves have shifted, but we still do need to think about those lap bands and the Roux and Y patients because they're still around. They haven't died. They haven't gone away. They haven't all been changed over to different procedures. They're going to still present with complications, especially those complications far out of their surgery that we need to think about. The case that we talked about back in 2017 was an internal hernia where if you miss that for a while, those patients are going to infarct their gut. They're going to have really bad outcomes. But if you jump on these patients quick, get your consultation with your surgeon who did the procedure or your surgical service that takes care of these patients, get the imaging that you need done quickly, you can really have some great outcomes in these patients. They can have a full recovery from these serious pathologies. But of course, we have to think about what procedure they had done, what are the most common complications, and then match those to the imaging that needs to be done. And again, getting consultation with your surgeon is going to be really critical. Arvin, thanks so much for reviewing all this with us.
Thank you.